Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated December 2nd. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Today's front page, top of the fold, landmark GSK building, land near sale. By Amanda Jones Hoyle, from the Research Triangle Park. GlaxoSmithKline has placed a sizable portfolio of unneeded land and space onto the market in a sale that could bring new names to the market and or significant relocations. At several of the sites, surveyors are hard at work, a usually reliable signal that ownership changes are in the works. In fact, sources close to the pharmaceutical company say Glaxo has found potential buyers for several of its vacated properties in RTP. It's unclear, though, whether the suitors are companies planning to renovate and occupy the existing buildings, or if they are real estate investment firms banking on finding a future corporate tenant. GSK, which has its U.S. headquarters in RTP, has over the past 6 months relocated about 1,000 of its 4,200 employees here from scattered properties around the region to newly renovated buildings on the company's Moore Drive campus. With the consolidation mostly finished, three buildings owned by Glaxo off Cornwallis Drive and two near the Imperial Center Business Park have been vacated. Glaxo owns about 690 acres inside Research Triangle Park, more land than any other RTP company. Even if the company sells that land, it would still have enough acreage to build at least five office or research buildings at its Moore Drive campus. GSK spokesman Robert Sutton would not confirm nor deny whether the company is negotiating with any buyers. Glaxo has hired both the Cushman & Wakefield and the Cassidy Turley real estate firms to market its RTP and Durham properties. Jim Allaire, senior managing director of Cassidy Turley's Raleigh office, would not comment about any pending deals for the Glaxo properties. Crown Realty and Development of Irvine, California, which owns 13 of the office, flex, and warehouse buildings in the Imperial Center Office Park, signaled its interest in buying Glaxo's two research buildings on Swabia Court near Imperial Center when it formed a new corporation called Crown Swabia Associates, LLC, in May. The two office buildings at 1035 Swabia Court and at 1015 Swabia Court have a combined 200,000 square feet of space and were built in 1987. The site includes a 16-acre lot for future development and is valued at $21.7 million, according to Durham County tax records. Craig Grote, executive vice president of Crown Realty, confirmed that he has looked at the Glaxo buildings for a potential acquisition, but he's not completely sold on the deal. Both buildings, he says, will require significant upfit and renovation to meet the demands of today's corporate tenants. Imperial Park is one of the premier assets in the Raleigh area, and it's important for us to continue to look at deals that could enhance the total park, Groke says. We're very, very sensitive to both the needs of the Imperial Center Park and its occupants and tenants. Glaxo is also trying to sell the iconic Elion Hitchings Building, the former Burroughs Welcome Building, at 3030 East Cornwallis Drive. The 550,000 square foot building sits on 100 acres and has a tax value of almost $36 million, according to Durham County tax records. Glaxo in early 2012 will demolish a building at 3029 East Cornwallis Drive because of its age and obsolescence, leaving its surrounding 107 acres of land ready for new development. The company is also seeking a buyer for two interconnected office buildings at 52 Maughan Drive with 150,000 square feet of laboratory and office space. Also on the front page, county and municipal debt drops as economy sags, by Lee Weisbecker from Raleigh. The issue of too much government borrowing may be the hot topic nationally in 2012. Not so at the local level in North Carolina. Total borrowing by the state's 100 counties and 6,900 cities and towns is actually going down. The North Carolina Department of State Treasurer, which keeps track of the matter, says statewide local debt levels declined by 0.3% in the 12 months ending October 31st, from $28.45 billion in 2010 to $28.36 billion in 2011. The decline is tied to the economic slowdown, says Tony Blaylock, president of the Carolinas Municipal Advisory Council, a group set up during the Great Depression that helps small towns and cities with their borrowing projects. I've seen borrowing decline four times, says Blaylock. Each time it was connected to a recession. Faced with smaller budgets or anemic revenue increases, local governments put off capital projects, roads, libraries, schools, museums, and other projects. That in turn means fewer trips to the bond markets for financing. Meanwhile, projects undertaken in earlier years come to a completion and are paid off. Those two factors combine to produce a drop in the overall borrowing figure. It's part of the cycle, says Blaylock. It'll come back when the dollars for capital projects get rolling again. That may not happen anytime soon. Some 56 of the state's 100 counties delayed, cut, or canceled building projects, including jails, courthouses, and health clinics, in the spending plans they adopted at the end of June, says Rebecca Troutman of the North Carolina Association of County Commissioners. Comparable figures for cities and towns are not yet available at the North Carolina League of Municipalities, based in Raleigh. The group is still compiling a report on fiscal 2012 budget actions. Spokesman Matt Lael says, however, that the expectation is that capital spending, which slowed in fiscal 2011, will show another decline at the city level for fiscal 2012. The latest condition report issued by the National League of Cities shows that 60% of 1,055 cities polled reported that they'd slashed capital spending budgets, one of the first items to go when money gets tight, according to the league's Christopher H. Honey. As for total local government borrowing in North Carolina, the $28 billion debt figure is split about evenly between city and county governments. The state's larger counties and cities bear the largest debt load and debt capacity. Still on the front page, bottom of the fold, hand off to business. NCSU's outstanding football Holt brothers team up to build a local company in development and construction. By Jason DeBruin from Raleigh. The brothers Holt don't like being told they can't succeed at something. It only makes them try harder. So when they were told they don't know anything about the construction industry, it only made them work to learn about it and to gather the right people around them. They now have launched Holt Brothers Construction and Holt Brothers Development to try to get their foot in the Triangle's building industry. For those still wondering, it is those Holt brothers, the ones who played football at North Carolina State University and later in the National Football League. I've always been interested in construction, says Terrence Holt, the younger of the two, who was a defensive back in the NFL for five seasons, four with the Detroit Lions. Although they may be more familiar with a post route than with a post hole, they know how to build a relationship and the work it takes to perform at a high level. We feel like this is a relationship-driven business anyway, says Torrey Holt, a likely first-ballot Hall of Famer who played for 10 seasons with the St. Louis Rams, a team with which he won Super Bowl 34. It's a performance-based business. At NC State, Terry Holt rewrote the record books by setting single-game, single-season career records in almost every passing category. He set an ACC record with 3,379 reception yards for his career and was named a consensus All-American in 1998. On defense at NCSU, Terrence Holt blocked seven field goals, including four in 2001, to tie a record and also blocked two punts. He had five interceptions and was a preseason candidate for the Bronco Nagurski Award, given to the nation's top defensive player. Now the Holts are busy learning their new jobs, and they are getting some help to get going. They've hired Leonard Barrier, Tony Davis, and Deborah Barrier, who combined for nearly 100 years of experience in construction management, much of that with A&M Construction in Raleigh. The trio has worked on projects including NC State's D.H. Hill Library and the East Carolina University Medical Center. Terrence, who has attended classes in construction management and plans to earn a general contractor's license, says, "We don't want to rely only on our own talent. Ideally, the Holt brothers will combine the experience from the construction managers with the relationships, cash, and financial backing from their notoriety to break into the construction business and not let go. Even though the conventional wisdom has it that a down economy is a bad time to start a company, especially a building company, the Holts say they are seeing only opportunities and take a glass-half-full approach. In fact, the economy has leveled the playing field because now every company is having to compete at the ground floor," Terrence says. Being minority-owned, Holt Brothers is HUB certified, a program that promotes historically underutilized businesses and state government contracting. The brothers say they will look to work with other minority-owned businesses. The Holts have immersed themselves into the local community since their NFL careers ended. They started a foundation in 1999 in memory of their mother, Orietta Holt Schaffner, who died of cancer in 1996. The foundation raises money to help children who are dealing with the severe illness of a parent. Kim Burke, president of the Raleigh African American Chamber of Commerce, hopes to see the Holt brothers' name recognition shine a light on some other minority-owned small business. "It's kind of hard to connect to good old boy networks," she says. "Unfortunately, there are not a lot of large businesses in Raleigh that are minority-owned." Holt Brothers has occupied an office near RDU International Airport since the beginning of this year, but has signed only small contracts so far. The brothers hope to land a contract with a national used car retailer soon and grow from there, but they want to stay within their means so they can deliver what they promise. "They want to focus on building a strong track record," says Terrence. Moving inside the front cover, coastal whiplash. Data reveal Wilmington coastal areas are biggest real estate drag in some banks' portfolios. By Lee Weisbecker from Raleigh. Years after its real estate market collapsed, Wilmington is still producing an outsized crop of problem loans for the books of Triangle and regional banks. The port city and surrounding counties are continuing a slow healing process from a downturn that pushed two community banks over the edge and has silenced the earth movers at a slew of upscale coastal housing developments now populated by weeds. "There is a certain sense that things have begun to stabilize now, but at lower prices," says UNC Wilmington economist Professor Tom Simpson. "Even so, current conditions remain a far cry from back in the mid-2000s, when the Wilmington region, with its coastal appeal and higher-than-average growth rate, was, for North Carolina bankers, the place to be. Those who answered that call subsequently saw the area's real estate prices drop by 25% off their 2006 highs, and bankers are still toting up the damage. Some evidence as of September 30, 2011, according to the SEC documents, are Cary-based Crescent State Bank, which entered the coastal market in 2006, says nearly 26% of its loans, about $150 million, emanated from the Wilmington region as of the third quarter. Of the total, $16 million, or 10%, are troubled and non-performing. Meanwhile, in the Triangle, where the bank has 58% of its total loans, only 6.4% are non-performers. Next, Raleigh-based North State Bank, with six total offices, says 31% of its total bad loan charge-offs are located in its single Wilmington office. And Troy-based First Bank, which entered the Port City Bank in 2009 by buying failed Cooperative Bank, reported $537 million in Eastern Region loans in the third quarter. The area includes Wilmington and Brunswick and four other coastal communities. On loan total, $65 million were troubled, a non-performing rate of 12%. That was higher than in any of the bank's other regions. Despite that pattern, First Bank wasn't deterred from its recent purchase of 11 new coastal branches, some in New Hanover and nearby Brunswick counties, from a Whiteville bank. "They are following through with an aggressive growth plan," says Keith Briet and Woods analyst Stephen Scouten. Also, Charleston, South Carolina-based First Federal Savings and Loan purchased Wilmington's second failed community bank, the Bank of Cape Fear, back in 2010. In reports filed with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, First Federal doesn't break out its non-performing loans by region. But the bank does report that the chunk of troubled assets it got in making the Cape Fear deal, some of which are covered by federal guarantees, had been whittled down by 26% to $113 million as of June. The Charlotte Bank has posted losses of $35 million through the third quarter of 2011, according to the FDIC. And a large majority of the troubled community bank assets in the Wilmington region are in the residential construction and commercial real estate areas. Wilmington's banking market, now dominated by large regional multi-state lenders, following the collapse of the two larger community banks, shrank by 1.6% to $5.77 billion in total deposits in the 12 months ending June 30th. What's the likelihood of a turnaround anytime soon? It will depend, in large part, on a real estate recovery. And that, despite signs of stabilization, doesn't appear in the immediate cards. An overhang of homes for sale, plus foreclosed and soon-to-be-foreclosed properties in the shadow supply, promise to clog the pipeline for months to come, says UNC Wilmington economist Woody Hall. All of that, he adds, will need to be absorbed before new construction can turn up and provide its usual impetus for expansion. Next up, giant Wendell Falls project goes belly up, by Amanda Jones Hoyle. From Wendell, the family-owned Burroughs and Chapin real estate company in Myrtle Beach is closing the books on its failed attempt to expand into the Triangle and has filed for bankruptcy liquidation of its Wendell Falls Development LLC affiliate. Wendell Falls Development LLC has nearly $9.5 million in remaining liabilities to Triangle area construction contractors, architects, engineers, lawyers, and marketing vendors, according to a Chapter 7 petition filed at U.S. Bankruptcy Court on November 28. The entity has no remaining assets. Wells Fargo Bank in 2010 foreclosed on all of the land that the Wendell Falls Development Partners had purchased for the 1,400-acre development in eastern Wake County, and the bank is actively seeking a buyer for the site. Burroughs and Chapin Company Incorporated had been developing residential, commercial, and resort properties in the Myrtle Beach area for more than 100 years and teamed with the Mercury Development real estate firm in Raleigh in 2005 as a 60% partner in the Wendell Falls development. Wendell Falls was slated to be the largest residential and commercial development in eastern Wake County, with construction plans approved for more than 4,000 homes and about 450,000 square feet of retail and commercial space, plus a 160-acre county park and an elementary school. The elementary school opened in 2009, and utility and roadwork for the first 350 residential lots was nearly complete when the developers were forced to pull the plug on the project in 2008. The Barnhill Contracting Company of Tarboro is still owed $3 million for its work on a highway interchange from the U.S. 64-264 Knightdale Bypass, and Fowler Contracting of Cary is owed $4.66 million for land grading work that was completed in 2008. Other companies owed money include the Klein Design Associates architecture firm in Raleigh, the Craig Jackson and Partners advertising firm in Chapel Hill, the Parker Poe Law Firm in Charleston, South Carolina, and the Lewis Berger Group engineering firm in Raleigh. Burroughs and Chapin came in hoping to expand their business model outside their local market and obviously regret that decision now, says John Northern, a Chapel Hill bankruptcy lawyer representing the developers in the bankruptcy case. It turned into a bad poster child for what should have been an amazing project. When questioned about the timing of the bankruptcy filing, Northern says the company wanted to wipe the slate clean before the end of 2011. I'm not aware of any other claims that'll be coming in, he says. When contacted in Myrtle Beach, Burroughs and Chapin spokeswoman Lee Gaynor says the company does not comment on pending legal matters. Mercury Development partner Greg Ferguson declined to comment about the case. Wells Fargo banking officials in October issued a request for proposals to investors interested in bidding on a bundle of eight properties the bank owns around the southeast, and the portfolio includes the Wendell Falls property. Sources say the property could be under contract to a potential buyer before the end of December. The Wendell Town Council renegotiated the development agreement for the Wendell Falls project in June. It is still anticipated that the project could one day bring in an additional $1 billion in taxable property for a town that currently has a population of only about 5,000 people. Next up, local executive retooling firm in Tennessee by Amanda Jones Hoyle from Raleigh. Since taking over as chairman and CEO of a Tennessee medical transcription company in July, former Mises and Allscripts executive Vern Davenport has brought in at least five healthcare industry executives from the Triangle to help him turn the company around. A steady stream of talent running from Raleigh to the headquarters at MedQuest Holdings, Incorporated in Franklin, Tennessee, has fueled speculation that the company could be looking to open an office in the Triangle or relocate its headquarters in the future. Both Davenport and MedQuest Chief Financial Officer Ron Scarborough, who joined the MedQuest in August, owns homes in Raleigh and commute back and forth to the Nashville, Tennessee suburb. Davenport also has recruited former Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina President and CEO Rob Gretchen to serve on MedQuest Board of Directors. MedQuest's new Senior Vice President of Human Resources, hired in October, is Bill Donovan, who prior to his appointment served as Executive Director of Ronald McDonald Charities for the Triangle, and before that led the Global Human Resources Organization at Nortel Networks and Research Triangle Park. The company also announced on November 28th that Matt Jenkins, a former vice president of corporate development at both Mises Healthcare and at Allscripts in Raleigh, had been put in charge of all acquisition, investment, and alliance opportunities. Frank Morgan, an analyst for RBC Capital Markets, who tracks MedQuest Holdings, says Davenport and his team are bringing fresh new skills to the company. It's a legacy business, and the strengths that Vern and Ron bring is background that can utilize the technology side, says Morgan. All the new hires seem to point where Vern wants to take the company. Also recently joining MedQuest's executive team are three of the former top executives and founders of M-Modal of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, a technology company that MedQuest acquired in August in a deal valued at $130 million. M-Modal develops speech recognition technology that turns dictation into structured information that can be used in electronic medical records. Neither Davenport nor Scarborough returned calls for comment, but in Davenport's discussion at the Piper Jaffray Healthcare Conference in New York City on November 30th, he noted that MedQuest employs about 6,000 medical record transcriptionists and other employees in the U.S., and another 8,000 transcriptionists who are outsourced to operations in India. MedQuest generated $158 million in profit on $417 million in revenue for its fiscal year that ended December 31st. In its most recent quarter, the company had a profit of $45 million on top-line revenue of $108 million. The company provides clinical documentation for 155,000 doctors working at more than 3,000 hospitals in the U.S., and it produces more than 3 billion lines of text annually. It claims to be the largest provider of medical transcription services in the U.S. healthcare system. But the future of the industry lies in speech recognition software that can also contextualize the text, Davenport says, or translate and transfer the text into a structured data field. Understanding that in a blob of words that certain words are referring to weight or that a reference to a left knee should go into the billing code for a left knee, he explains, I think we'll begin to see a shift from dictation transcription to the patient story and the physician narrative. In an analyst report issued shortly after MedQuest released its third quarter financial report in November, Lazard Capital Markets analyst Stephen Unger highlighted that MedQuest has the advantage over many of the small companies in the medical transcription industry because of its ability to invest in new technology that makes it easier for physicians to transcribe medical files. The MedQuest story has quickly changed from one involving gross margin expansion, an IPO in February, to volume growth, first quarter 2011, to industry consolidation, second quarter 2011. And now the development and sale of innovative software application into the customer base, a strategic direction of new management. That is the latest MedQuest story. Next up, Raleigh developers turn to non-rated bonds to build. By Lee Weisbecker from Raleigh. There are investment-grade bonds that have received the stamp of approval from credit rating services. There are junk bonds that have a rating below investment grade. And finally, there are unrated bonds where the investors who buy them are left to watch their own backs. Developers of two Raleigh projects, the Valentine Commons Student Apartments off Hillsborough Street near North Carolina State University, and Searstone, a planned retirement community in Cary, have turned to the third category to get their projects off the ground. A $21.5 million tax-exempt bond package for Valentine, paying those who buy them a hefty annual interest of 11%, has already been sold. The Searstone package of $114 million will go to market late this year or in early 2012, says Elizabeth Stevens of the Wisconsin-based Public Finance Authority, or PFA, the group structuring both Raleigh deals. In looking into PFA, the developers of the Raleigh projects opted for a new wrinkle in municipal finance. Linked to a private California bond group, HB Capital Resources Limited, PFA was set up less than 2 years ago following approval of a law by the Wisconsin legislature. It promptly became the first ever such organization to begin searching nationwide for local government and private deals to finance and, on its website, list a portfolio of 15 far-flung projects with which it's been involved. Conduit financing, it's called. The Atlanta-based Samaritan Housing Foundation, Incorporated, the developer of 169-unit Searstone, turned to PFA after the North Carolina Medical Care Commission declined to structure a bond package, calling the project too risky in the current environment. Samaritan has appealed that decision. Meanwhile, finance officials from across the country have looked into PFA and are continuing to scratch their heads over its model. Some critics say it lacks transparency and second-guesses local regulatory authority. The National Council of Development Finance Agencies hasn't taken a formal position, but is studying the matter. Its president, Toby Rittner, says the major issue will be to make sure multi-state bond issuers such as PFA are adhering to state and local laws. PFA's Stephen counters that the group, which is set up as a political subdivision of the state of Wisconsin, is simply out there to create an alternative and provide a valuable service. It is up to the developer of each PFA project, she added, to decide whether to seek an agency rating for their particular bond package. Valentine and Searstone decided on their own to go to the market unrated. These bonds are only being offered to sophisticated, accredited investors, says Stevens, adding that the credit markets have changed drastically since the meltdown of 2008. Having unrated debt is not an impediment to selling bonds, he says. In issuing the bonds, PFA assumed no repayment risk. The bond buyers of the 277-unit Valentine and ultimately the Searstone projects will be repaid from the proceeds generated by each development. Valentine, which is being developed by Capstone Companies of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, is expected to be completed by July 2012, says Jeff Merlson of the Hillsborough Street Community Service Corporation. Tony Blaylock, who heads up the Raleigh-based Carolina Municipal Advisory Council, which rates bond issues for smaller cities and towns, says unrated debt is nothing new, especially in the retirement community sector. It brings investors a higher rate of return for assuming higher risk. Even so, buyers of unrated debt have a particular burden. It's up to them to do extra due diligence, Blaylock says. Continuing on, Raleigh's bankrupt LEA says Taser infringed on its patent. By Chris Bagley. From Raleigh. Taser International Incorporated, a frequent target of lawsuits that claim debilitating injuries caused by its Taser stun gun products, is now being sued by a bankrupt company for alleged patent infringement. Raleigh-based security contractor, Law Enforcement Associates Incorporated, alleges that Taser's double and triple shot stun guns infringed on a patent related to the discharge of electrical current. The lawsuit filed November 23rd alleges that the two companies agreed in 2009 that Taser would pay $350,000 for the patent, two other patents, and 10 pending patents, but that Taser didn't follow through with the purchase. The lawsuit alleges that Scottsdale, Arizona-based Taser has infringed on the electrical patent since at least 2008. Taser began developing the weapons in 2005, according to its website. LEA filed for the patent in 2006 and received it in 2010, according to patent documents it filed as part of the lawsuit. LEA filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy in July in order to restructure nearly $1.7 million in liability, including a $1.1 million jury award to an aggrieved shareholder and more than $300,000 in attorney fees. Separately, LEA still faces a lawsuit brought by former President Paul Feldman and sales director Martin Perry, who claim they were fired for their cooperation with a federal investigation into an illegal exporting relationship. That litigation has been put on hold while the bankruptcy case proceeds. Patent lawsuits are risky and potentially expensive for companies in bankruptcy, said patent attorney Jeff Wilson of Jenkins Wilson in Durham, who is not involved in the litigation. Citing a study by the American Intellectual Property Law Association, Wilson says the average infringement plaintiff spends in the range of $2 million to take a single patent claim through discovery, a pretrial phase when plaintiffs and defendants obtain reams and countless megabytes of documents from one another. Those costs don't include an eventual trial or defense against any counterclaims, Wilson says. The scheduling set by the court is pretty rigorous and the costs are going to be high, Wilson says. A tentative Chapter 11 plan filed November 22nd sketches out a restructuring and a potential path to financial stability for LEA. The company reported a net loss of $4.3 million on revenue of $5.5 million in the 12 months to March 31st, according to the last quarterly report it filed before bankruptcy. For a company in bankruptcy, such litigation can require the consent of its court-appointed bankruptcy trustee, Wilson says. One reason is that patent attorneys bill for services rendered and rarely take litigation on a contingency basis, Wilson says. LEA attorney Jonathan Hall declined to comment. Taser spokesman Steve Tuttle declined to comment other than to say the company had not been served with the lawsuit as of November 30th. Taser's various electronic devices are used by thousands of law enforcement agencies in the United States as a less-than-lethal means of incapacitating a potentially dangerous person. While the company says it has successfully defended itself against more than 60 injury-related lawsuits, it also settled with a dozen or more plaintiffs and lost a small handful of wrongful death lawsuits, with jury awards totaling several million dollars. LEA's patent in question covers a dart designed to freeze its target's muscles by discharging less electricity but for a longer time. The system also dispenses with the cables that connect the dart to an officer's handheld device, a change that results in less danger to the officer. Next up, Duke outpaces others in tech transfer field by Jason DeBrun from Raleigh. Revenue to universities from inventions or discoveries took another hit this year, with North Carolina State University being alone among the Triangle's three biggest schools to record a gain. In terms of total revenue, Duke University outpaces the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and NC State. Despite a 6% decrease from 2010, Duke reported $24.2 million in revenue last fiscal year, exponentially more than NC State's $5.2 million and UNCCH's $2.2 million. Professors and researchers in higher education develop new products or upgrades to existing devices. If they have something that can be patented, a licensing office at the university will help file the paperwork and set the professor up with a way to further develop the product under intellectual property protection. If and when that product or device begins generating revenue, the universities have a contract to receive a percentage of the revenue. Companies such as Bioptogen which takes detailed images of the human eye, and Nanoforge, which makes manufacturing nanowires, have spun out of Duke, for example, while a company like G-Zero Therapeutics, which is developing a cancer-fighting process, is still in development at UNC Chapel Hill. Rose Ritz, executive director of the Duke University Office of Licensing and Ventures, points to the biomimetrics as a particular success from the university this year. Denver, Colorado-based Omni Biopharmaceutical acquired a 25% ownership in biomimetrics, which develops cancer-fighting compounds, for $2 million and signed an exclusive licensing agreement with Duke. This year, NC State expanded its new venture services to provide direct help to its faculty or students who want to commercialize the idea. Called NC State Fast 15, it will help 15 companies go through the hoops of forming a business so the researchers can focus on the product and not get bogged down in the business development. "We are trying to build this campus-wide culture of innovation and entrepreneurship," says Billy Hodling, executive director of the North Carolina State Office of Technology Transfer. More than 80 companies have spun out of the university, resulting in 6,000 new jobs, half of which are in North Carolina. "That is so incredibly important for a land-grant institution like NC State," Hodling says. UNC Chapel Hill does not have a program like NC State Fast 15, but Kathy Ennis, executive director of the Office of Technology Transfer at UNCCH, says she is thinking about borrowing some of Hodling's ideas. "They've got some nice things going at NC State," she says. Spinoff companies from UNCCH have been on the rise in recent years. In the middle of the past decade, the university would average about 3 spinoff companies per year. In recent years, that doubled, Ennis says. In addition, the university established a boilerplate licensing agreement that a researcher may sign with the university, saving the time and cost of hiring legal representation to hash out terms. Ennis points out that UNC's spinoff companies tend to be in the medical field and, as such, can take longer to generate revenue than technology companies, which are more prevalent from NC State. Compared with some of the other universities, Duke matches up well. Harvard University, for example, reported $13.8 million in licensing revenue last year. Of course, other universities have much more robust programs. The Massachusetts Institute of Technology reported $85 million of cash income and $70 million in royalties last year. And the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor reported $40 million in royalty and equity sales in 2010. What's next? Meredith Plotting Future, But Won't Be Co-Ed, by Jason DeBruin. From Raleigh, leaders of Meredith College are plotting a strategy for growth, but unlike at crosstown institution William Peace University, the women's school will not admit men to do so. Meredith Board has approved spending $2 million in developing a strategic plan. Based on what comes out of the plan, the board hopes to make more multi-year investments to support financial aid, new academic programs, and faculty and staff development, with the goal of enhancing Meredith's profile in the state, region, and says board chairwoman Nancy Cheek. Some changes are already in the works. For the 2011-12 school year, 5 new academic programs have been introduced, including a Business Foundation certificate program for graduates and an undergraduate degree in criminology, the first women's college in the state to offer such a program. In the athletic arena, Meredith will add a lacrosse team next year as its 7th varsity sport. College President Joe Allen says she wants to make Meredith the women's college best known for leadership development. "Meredith is not as well known as it ought to be," she says. "We have powerful graduates that people just don't know about." Among noted Meredith graduates are Sarah Parker, Chief Justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court, and journalist Judy Woodruff. As for going coeducational, Allen says it was gut-wrenching when she learned the former Peace College would admit men. She says as long as she and the current board are leading Meredith, it will not follow suit. Financially, Meredith has experienced declines in the past few years. Total revenue has fallen, and the college posted a $7 million net deficit in 2009 and a $4 million net deficit in 2010, according to tax information filed with the Internal Revenue Service. Allen took over the president's office on July 1st, becoming the first Meredith alumni, class of 80, to hold the position. She puts value on operational issues such as enrollment, financial stability, and facilities, but makes clear that the academics is the highest priority. A leadership team from Meredith will work with a consultant to come up with a vision for Meredith and set out plans for the coming 3, 6, and 9 years. We want to emphasize that personal touch that Meredith is known for, Allen says, but at the same time, she doesn't want to just tell Meredith's same old story. Particularly, Allen wants to work with groups such as the Raleigh Chamber of Commerce to help alumni graduate into leadership roles. She also hopes to increase enrollment from the current 2,000 to between 2,500 and 3,000 in the coming decade. During the strategic planning process, the college will involve current students and alumni with faculty, staff, and outside business leaders to elicit a variety of thoughts and opinions. Allen calls the board's initial $2 million investment critical to launching the strategic planning process. It's no surprise that women's liberal arts colleges face many of the same challenges of small co-ed institutions, says Susan Lennon, president of the Women's College Coalition, citing the lack of visibility as just one difficulty. In addition, so many people don't know about women's colleges and don't understand what they are, she says. It's about the education and success of women and girls. And now, Retail Strip Buyer Claims Deception in Trade by Chris Bagley. The new owner of the Wakefield Commons Shopping Center said it was taken aback to learn just 5 days after paying $25 million that the anchor Kroger grocery store was about to close. Now the owner, Westdale Recap Properties Limited, is pointing the finger at the seller, Centro NP LLC, claiming in a lawsuit that Centro concealed the Kroger's financial troubles. The suit contends that representatives of Centro claimed the Kroger was profitable despite knowing that it wasn't and that its revenue was declining. Had Westdale been advised or known of the financial difficulties of the Kroger store, Westdale would not have purchased the property, attorneys Jim Roberts and Scott Griffith wrote in the lawsuit. The closure of the Kroger store has dramatically and negatively impacted the value and the financial viability of the property. Westdale had many prospective tenants ready to lease space at the property, but they refused to sign leases once the Kroger store ceased operation. Kroger owned its 61,500 square foot building and continues to own it after vacating it in July. The 166,000 square foot shopping center is on New Falls of the News Road at Capitol Boulevard, straddling the boundary between Raleigh and Wake Forest. Center tenants estimate that 6 to 8 spaces in the shopping center have remained empty since the Kroger's disappearance. Several said foot traffic had slowed somewhat, but they said they couldn't point to direct impacts immediate on their own businesses. Brian Hoyle, marketing director for iCare Associates, says his company's customers several doors down from the Kroger come in mainly for annual appointments rather than on spur of the moment. Effects from the Kroger's closing may show up several months in the future, Hoyle said. Only time will tell, Hoyle says. You're depending on that anchor. The suit, filed November 17th in federal court for the Eastern District of North Carolina, seeks unspecified compensatory and punitive damages. It alleges fraud, breach of covenant of good faith, and deceptive trade practices. The lawsuit alleges that a Kroger regional manager emailed his contacts at Centro in September 2009, informing them that the store was on track to lose close to $1 million that year. The suit also cites an email exchange between two Centro representatives in which they allegedly discussed the Kroger store's financial difficulties. Stacy Slater, a spokeswoman for the seller, declined to comment, citing the ongoing nature of the litigation. Centro, the U.S. unit of the Australian company, was sold to Blackstone Group LP in June and is now known as Brixmore LLC. Roberts declined to comment. Griffith didn't return a call seeking comment. All companies involved are giants based outside of North Carolina. New York-based Brixmor owns nearly 600 shopping centers nationwide, and its sale to Blackstone valued it at $9.4 billion. Dallas, Texas-based Westdale owns or manages nearly 200 apartment complexes and several commercial properties throughout the southern and southwestern United States. The Kroger Company, which is based in Cincinnati and not named as a defendant, has 2,400 stores nationwide. Brixmor has a significant presence in North Carolina. Its 23 properties in the state include Devonshire Place on Walnut Street in Cary, Siler Crossing in Chatham County, Roxborough Square, and three shopping centers in Wilmington. And now it's time for a better world. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. From the Philanthropy News Desk of Todd Cohen, Safe Child, a Stop for Abused Kids. In the past year, Child Protective Services Unit of the Wake County Department of Social Services, as well as the Wake County Sheriff's Office and local police departments in the county, submitted 237 requests to Safe Child's new Children Advocacy Center to conduct medical evaluations of children who had been sexually or physically abused. The center, which opened in October 2010, handled 97 of those cases. The center uses a multidisciplinary team approach to assist local agencies that investigate, prosecute, and treat abuse. Before the center opened, a child in Wake County who was sexually or physically abused would have to navigate, while in trauma and crisis, a very complicated system of agencies and professionals, says Kristen DeRona, the center's director. And these kids were being re-traumatized over and over again by having to retell their stories, she says. There wasn't a coordinated, streamlined approach to these investigations. Before the center opened, scheduling an evaluation could take well over a month compared to 10 to 14 business days at Safe Child's Center. And kids and their families, as well as professionals involved in the evaluations, had to make visits, sometimes more than once, to WakeMed, the only location in Raleigh where evaluations were conducted, or to Duke Medical Center in Durham, UNC's hospitals in Chapel Hill, or University Health Systems in Greenville. The new center operates with an annual operating cost of $322,000 and a staff of 3 employees plus 2 part-time medical practitioners. Grants cover 53% of the cost of operating the center, with donations and fundraising covering another 24% and insurance reimbursements covering 23%. Medical evaluation consists of an interview, medical examination, multidisciplinary review of the case, and advocacy child support services. Participating in the review are the center and its collaborating partners, including the Wake District Attorney's Office, Wake Child Protective Services, Sheriff's Office and Police, medical professionals, mental health providers, and Wake County Public Schools. No one professional knows every single thing about what needs to happen in these investigations, DeRona says. We need to work together as a team to provide the best outcomes for the healing of the child, but also the best outcomes for the prosecution of the offenders to keep the child safe and our community safe. The interview and medical exam alone take 2 to 3 hours, and the interview is conducted by a center staff member, digitally recorded and observed live on a monitor in a different room by the referring professionals. With its current staffing, the center can see 3 to 5 children a week, or a maximum of 20 a month, compared to 10 to 12 a week it could see if it had a full team of medical professionals, DeRojo says. To add a full-time medical practitioner for the center, Safe Child has launched a campaign to raise $200,000 and already has raised nearly $120,000. A key goal for the center, DeRojo says, is to increase our capacity to see more kids and get them in sooner. And now from the opinion page. State jobs cuts in North Carolina are overstated, by Matt Willoughby. Some Democrats and social justice advocates in North Carolina continue to throw around huge numbers of people who have been laid off due to cuts in the state budget. Representative Bill Faison, Democrat in Durham, claimed in a press release that more than 6,000 state jobs were lost because of the cuts and more state workers would lose their jobs. A coalition of liberal organizations called Together in North Carolina predicts 30,000 workers, public and private combined, will lose their jobs by 2013 because of the budget cuts. It's not clear how that number was reached, but at least one claim the group is making is misleading. There is an assertion the North Carolina Department of Transportation laid off 400 workers due to the budget cuts. A spokeswoman at the Department of Transportation, Greer Beatty, says 441 workers were notified that their jobs would be phased out by June 30. She said most already have found other jobs within state government or the private sector. Others have taken early retirement. The department's human resources staff worked to find those employees other jobs. If none could be found, and if the workers didn't qualify for early retirement, then they could be eligible for a severance package. However, some workers could be forced to accept pay cuts. If the department found the employee in another position and the employee refused to take it, even if it paid less, that person would not qualify for severance pay. A new report from the Office of State Budget and Management finds 1,633 state employees were receiving a severance package due to a reduction in force, including 516 local district education jobs. Furthermore, Together NC claims the UNC system was forced to end 3,000 jobs, yet the budget office report shows only 243 receiving severance. The severance package includes a full salary and health benefits for up to a year. As of November 1st, the Office of State Budget and Management allocated nearly $24 million for severance benefits. Other public records also show that gigantic layoff claims are way off. State agencies must inform the Office of State Personnel any time an employee is laid off. In September, an official in that office told the Civitas Institute that the record showed less than 1,000 state employees had lost jobs since the current budget went into effect in June. That number didn't include local education positions. Even with layoffs, there are still plenty of job openings in the state government. The Office of State Personnel lists on its website more than 500 positions to be filled. Mr. Willoughby is a writer for the Civitas Institute in Raleigh. This week's guest opinion is Louisa Warren. Food stamps softened recession's blow. While the Great Recession technically ended in mid-2009, its effects on North Carolina's workers and families have dragged on. High unemployment and underemployment have led to increases in numerous measures of economic hardship, including hunger. More than 2 million North Carolinians faced food hardship in 2010. For more than a million individuals in North Carolina facing hunger, the state's food stamps program provided a vital lifeline. Participation in the program has surged since the start of the recession, with the equivalent of the population of Charlotte being added to the program. One measure of hunger is food hardship. Collected through a national daily survey, a household is determined to be suffering from food hardship when it does not have enough money to buy needed food at some point over a 12-month period. By this measure, nearly 1 in 4 North Carolinians, or 2.2 million people, faced food hardships in 2010. North Carolina has the 6th highest rate of food hardships of the 50 states, up from 13th highest in 2008. High rates of food hardship have plagued North Carolina's metropolitan areas. According to 2010 data, out of the 100 largest metropolitan statistical areas in the country, 3 in North Carolina made the top 10 list for the highest food hardships rates. Winston-Salem had the 3rd highest food hardship rate in the country, 25%, followed by Greensboro, High Point at the 4th highest, 24.9%, and Asheville as the 7th highest, 23.9%. The impacts of food hardship are not confined to the families who struggle to put food on their tables. Hunger affects educational, health care, and productivity outcomes. These consequences of hunger can be added up and quantified in North Carolina's hunger bill. In order to determine the cost of hunger, several researchers nationally have looked at the following factors. Hunger-induced illnesses such as iron deficiency, headaches, depression, and poor overall health status. Hunger induced costs for lower educational outcomes, such as dropout and special education services, as well as the impact on lifetime earnings. Cost of charitable contributions made to alleviate hunger and food insecurity, including food banks and volunteers. The researchers examined the extensive academic literature exploring the economic consequences of hunger and estimated North Carolina's hunger bill to be $5.44 billion in 2010. Put another way, North Carolina's hunger bill costs the state $568 per Tar Heel annually. Like hunger itself, the state's hunger bill jumped by 31.5% over the course of the Great Recession. North Carolina is one of 12 states that experienced an increase in their hunger bills of $1 billion or more from 2007 to 2010. For many of those facing food hardship, North Carolina's food stamp program called Food and Nutritional Services has provided significant relief and put food on the table during times of financial crisis. Federally funded, the food stamp program helps eligible low-income families purchase basic groceries by giving them a modest monthly benefit that is set on a sliding scale based on income and household size. In 2010, the average monthly food stamps benefit for a household was $282. The number of individuals receiving food assistance through the North Carolina Food and Nutrition Services has nearly doubled since the Great Recession started in December 2007, an increase of 94.6%. The state has added more than 870,000 Tar Heels to its food assistance program, a little more than the population of Charlotte. As of September 2011, nearly 1 in 5 North Carolinians received food assistance. At the local level, the number of persons in households receiving food stamps has grown in every county since the recession began. Urban counties have seen the greatest numbers of people enrolled in the food stamps program, but rural areas have seen the deepest change in relative terms. The 5 counties with the largest percentage increases in their food stamp participation rates, at least quadrupling from September 27 to September 2011, are Dare, Jones, Pender, Gates, and Duplin counties. Hunger in North Carolina has risen significantly since the beginning of the Great Recession, as have the economic, health, and educational costs associated with it. The food stamps program has stemmed the effects of job losses for more than a million Tar Heels over the last several years, and while funded federally, the state of North Carolina and counties have a critical role in supporting an effective anti-hunger program. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This episode of the Triangle Business Journal will be available for download from the TRRS website momentarily. The web address is triangleReadingService.org. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.